Okay, welcome everyone. Thank you all for coming. We have a very hard stop at 12:15 because lunch is going to be served immediately at 12:15, as I have a full lunch program for the awards for reporting on the environment. So we're going to get started. I know other people will continue to come in. So welcome today to Criminal Elements, Organized Crime and Natural Resources. I'm Megan Parker. I'm the senior writer-editor at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. I'm also the editor of the new Security Beat, where we have long, for the last 10 years, actually looked at the relationship between environmental issues and national security, such as how competition for scarce resources might lead to conflict or to instability. We have only recently, however, begun to really look at the role of crime and its connections to security threats. But the magnitude of the issues have become increasingly more pressing. A recent UN Environment Program and Interpol joint report called The Rise of Environmental Crime estimates that environmental crime is the fourth largest criminal sector by value after drug trafficking, counterfeiting, and human trafficking. And, of course, the impacts are similarly huge in terms of lost tax revenue to governance, lost livelihoods for communities, and lost lives. We are still learning a lot about this, and particularly about the role of transnational criminal networks in environmental crime and the relationship between environmental crime and drug trafficking, and as well as terrorism and insurgent groups. But we still don't know much. So that's why I'm very excited to introduce this panel of experts who are going to help us better understand environmental crime and tell us about their work to prevent it, to prosecute it, and to report on it. One update on the program. Earlier, we were going to have Barbara Fraser, who's a freelance reporter based in Peru and an SEJ member that many of you might know. She's unable to come to Pittsburgh this year due to illness, but she's a great resource if you do know her. And due to a schedule change, John Webb will be appearing on a panel tomorrow at noon that I encourage you to attend as well. So first, let me introduce our folks here today. Mary Rowan is the Senior Wildlife Advisor at the U.S. Agency for International Development, where she coordinates USAID's programs on wildlife trafficking. And she also serves on the U.S. Government Interagency Task Force on Wildlife Trafficking. Jeremy Korzenick is the Senior Trial Attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice. He served in the Environmental Crimes Section for 26 years, where he has prosecuted cases under all major environmental statutes, including the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. He's going to give us a little context of the work that it happens here in the U.S. And Carla Mendez is a freelance investigative reporter who's based in Rio de Janeiro. Her recent reporting for Thomson Reuters has looked at land issues, including illegal logging and illegal mining. And part of that work was supported by SEJ's Parallel Partners program, which I encourage you to check out. There is a current call for proposals under the Fund for Environmental Journalism that's related to the Parallel Partners program. So before we get started, a few logistical notes. First, I'm going to ask the speakers to stick very tightly to 10 minutes so that we have each, so that we have enough time for robust Q&A. So please think about your questions during the panel and make sure you have a question, not a speech. When we get to Q&A, remember that it's SEJ members and active journalists first, and then we have additional time other attendees may ask questions. There will be time to chat with some of the folks later at the conference. There are some resources in the back, on the back table, as well as posted online on the SEJ agenda. And finally, just again, a reminder that we're going to have to hustle out of here to lunch at 12:15. So we'll start with Mary.
Great. Thank you, Megan, and good morning, everyone. What I'm going to try and do is give a quick overview of the scope of the problem of wildlife trafficking, give an idea of what USAID does. I have some cards back there which have lots of websites, so I'm not going to be able to cover a fraction of what we do, so please use those. And then some colleagues and I came up with some questions or some things that we think might be useful for journalists to really highlight and where we could really use the help in fighting this global scourge. I think most people know about the issues with ivory and rhino horn, but really all taxa, so many taxa are involved in wildlife trafficking, wildlife are trafficked for luxury items, for artwork, and for the fashion industry, medicinal uses, pet trade, that's a big issue here in the U.S., for food, both for the pot and also for ceremonial issues. And I think, one, if folks don't know, this critter in the middle on the left is a pangolin, and that is recently touted as the most trafficked mammal in the world. There are 8 species. It generates a lot of money. The reason why this is such a large range, 5 to 20, is different folks count different taxa when they're tallying this up. But you can see here that it is tons and tons of animals for everything that's imaginable. And then that bottom one is very frightening. It's 1,000 rangers have been killed over the last 10 years. Criminal networks are stronger. They outpower the rangers. This is, you know, different than the poaching of 50 years ago. This is an organized crime. I highlight this report from Global Financial Integrity that they produced earlier this year just to show of the 11 transnational crimes they highlight, 3 are biological natural resources, trees, fish, wildlife. It's a big problem. These 2 graphs, the upper one shows the reptile skins. The dark circles are where the reptiles are from, and the gray or beige circle or grayish circles up north are where the skins are going. And you can see it's North America, Europe, and Asia. And the bottom is one snapshot from a traffic report of large-scale ivory seizures. And you can see these are all transnational crimes. You can see the huge movement from Africa to Asia, both from East Africa and the West Africa, which is really a collecting point for a lot of the forest elephants in the Congo Basin. Or shall I say, from the slaughtered elephants in their ivory. So, USAID, for those of you who don't know, we are the development side of the government, the international development side. And we see biodiversity as a foundation for development. Rural communities require and rely on natural resources, forests for all sorts of products. Wild-caught fisheries are a huge issue for food security. And increasingly, probably the largest growing business is wildlife-based tourism, nature-based tourism. And you find in many developing countries that wildlife tourism may be number 1, 2, 3 foreign exchange earner. And that provides opportunities both in for government and for the wealthy, but it also provides income and opportunities at the rural communities. Just briefly, this is a map of northern Kenya. It's from Northern Rangelands Trust. USAID's been working on community conservation and biodiversity for the last 30 years. I actually did my doctorate in this area when I was there 30 years ago. God, that sounds long ago. The only thing you would see on this map were the green blotches. The beige ones didn't occur. Those are community areas. When I was there, cattle raiding was rampant. There was a lot of poaching. There was wildlife conflict between communities and wildlife. Through work that's gone on with conservancies, through USAID and other donors, and work with communities to put more land under wildlife friendly, reduce wildlife livestock conflict, still keeping with their livestock, but also increase opportunities for economic growth through wildlife-based tourism and other wildlife-friendly activities. This is a great story, and actually, if you check on BBC, but not right now, please, there's a story today on the Northern Rangelands Trust and the peace officer, and it really gives a great story. One quick thing. I remember talking to an old Samburu guy, and he said, you know, for the first time in his life, he could sleep without his shoes on because he didn't have to worry about cattle raiding in the middle of the night. So it's a security, it's an income, it's governance. Wildlife crime hurts that. It does. In this area where you have strong communities, actually the poaching is down because they have very good relationships with protected area authorities. But there are a lot of places where those community conservancies do not exist. And wildlife certainly the poaching kills rangers. Rural communities are subject to all sorts of insecurity from criminals coming in. And what increasingly we want countries to realize is that the natural resource base for their tourism is at threat. And that is a huge foreign exchange earner. So overall, environmental crime undermines development. It threatens rule of law and makes communities unstable in terms of having criminals there. If they lose their livelihoods, then you have migration. So what are we doing? We're part of the U.S. task force. We have long done protected area management work with communities. In terms of that second part, dismantling and disrupting trafficking, really it's working along the enforcement chain, because anti-poaching is one thing, but what you really want to try and do is get the middlemen and the kingpins. And so it's working on effective forensics, working with judges and prosecutors to better implement laws, working on improving laws, and working with other groups that are involved in the transcontinental nature of this. And then reducing demand. This is really, it's not environmental education or awareness, although that's part of it, but it's changing the behavior of someone who's choosing to buy this item. And if you think, how many here had a New Year's resolution? Raise your hand. How many of you have kept it? Behavior change is hard. Congratulations back there. Behavior change is hard. And so when someone's traditionally, they grew up using bear bile for medicine, how do you change that? How do you provide an alternative? And so that's a large part of the demand reduction. Just briefly, the scope of the response, you get more information on the cards. We're currently spending about $60 to $70 million a year on combating wildlife trafficking. And most of our work is at the country level, but we do have some global and regional programs, and happy to discuss those in the margins. So what's needed? There's often a lot of emphasis on arrests. There's much less emphasis on the convictions or the failure to convict. And so it's publicizing, any one arrest certainly may not lead to a conviction, but if it's a pattern, if they never lead to conviction, or if the criminals are through corruption or going out the back door of the jail, that's something that needs greater awareness of it happening. Corruption writ large, from the lowest level to the highest level, needs some attention. And also, increasingly, conservation groups and folks combating wildlife trafficking are working with the banks because the old adage, follow the money. There's a lot of illicit flows. It's combining with drug money. It's combining with all sorts of illicit funds, and really prosecuting on money laundering and bringing that to attention. In terms of demand reduction, need to highlight the vendors and the buyers who are still buying and selling. Influence buying trends. Right now, a lot of the rhino horn that's being sold, it's a status item. It's, I have this, have a party and bring out some rhino horn because it'll help cure your hangover. What it's really showing is the person who has it is the status because they can afford this wealthy item. How do we change it so that person bringing out an expensive box of chocolates or an expensive bottle of wine is better status, and how having that rhino horn is less cool? And then getting, I've actually spoken to a number of people here, and it's sort of environmental awareness. Do people know that species are going extinct? In a lot of places, that may not be an issue that actually gets people to conserve, and it may have the reverse effect in terms of, if it's rare, then I want it. And so it can have the alternative effect of actually driving it. And so very much making sure that the message fits the cultural context. And that's something that we work on in our demand reduction campaigns. And I think publicizing that is important. And those are some ideas we've had. And happy and look forward to having a good Q&A session. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary. Thanks. I'm going to ask Jeremy to come on up here while I pull up his PowerPoint. And I do encourage everyone to pick up the cards back there that Mary brought in that have some links to even more of information on their work. There we go.
All right, first, an obligatory disclaimer. I work for the Department of Justice, but I don't express their opinions. So what I say here hopefully will be fact-based. If you want my opinions, if you care to, you have to buy me a beer later on. I work for the Environmental Crime Section of the Department of Justice. It is a section by name. You can tell we prosecute environmental crimes. That's fairly broadly based. Much of the prosecution I've done over the years has been involved pollution crimes and fits in to some extent with the panel here in that we do see clean water and clean air as a resource as well, and have sought to not just to protect those resources, but to make more of them. Today, talking about the topic here being wildlife crimes, I and my colleagues prosecute them. They have particular challenges, and the first challenge is one that's shared with other environmental crimes. These crimes are unique in that there's criminal sanctions now for conduct that has been historically perfectly legal. So very different than other kinds of crimes that everybody knows when they engage in them. Homicide, theft, fraud. You don't have to be a legal scholar to know that those are contrary to law and that you're acting contrary to law. Environmental crimes are a little different. When I started doing this back as an assistant attorney general in New Hampshire, wasn't that many years before that people brought their junk out to the town dump in the middle of the woods and just dumped it there. Waste was regularly disposed of in rivers. You burned anything you wanted. That wasn't against the law. If you needed timber, you went to the forest and cut down trees. If you needed food to eat, you took your gun out and hunted whatever you wanted. If you wanted something for an animal for ornament, you just shot it and took it and mounted it. That's no longer the case. But I think, as Mary was indicating, behavioral changes are required. And prior to behavioral changes, there have to be attitudinal changes. And the recognition that these things that we're trying to protect are resources and they're limited resources, and that has been part of the effort of effective criminal enforcement of wildlife and resource crimes. There's also another challenge, and that's a jurisdictional one. There are sort of two kinds of wildlife protection statutes, essentially. The ones that most of us are familiar with are the ones that involve domestic misconduct. So requirements that you have fishing licenses, hunting licenses, that there are catch limits, things that where the crime, the violation of the limitation is here in the United States. So we can reach it. It's within our jurisdiction. The effort here in wildlife crimes and resource crimes has been, and you've seen Mary's presentation, how do you domesticate? How do you bring within the jurisdiction of people like me conduct that was committed, wrongful conduct that was committed extraterritorially in other countries, remotely? And also something that particularly for a criminal prosecutor, has its own challenge. When you're prosecuting somebody here for importing a rhino horn or some other item that was taken as a part of an animal or the whole animal taken improperly or illegally elsewhere, isn't there some perhaps attenuation of criminal liability? So you're not getting the person who shot the rhino. You're getting maybe three or four steps out from that illegal conduct. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be prosecuted, but we're prosecuting that importation in order to change behavior in a foreign country. And or with timber, for example, to limit the demand for a particular resource. Let me give you an example of the effort in the pollution area to domesticate a crime elsewhere, something that's outside of our jurisdiction. And it starts really with our biggest effort, or initially when I started, vessel pollution, where there are ships dumping oil, dumping waste oil, out in the high seas, beyond the reach of our laws. And there have been, as there have been in wildlife, efforts to stop that conduct by passage of international treaties, and to and this is just giving you some sense of the impact of that on wildlife as well, of the discharge of oily water from ships. Annually, waste oil discharges 8 times the volume of the Exxon Valdez just from shipping companies trying to save money, not putting in tanks the waste that they should, disposing it on shore, but disposing it on the high seas. There have been a whole bunch of statutes passed. I'm not going to go into detail, but the gist of it is that most of the prosecutions of discharging of oil in the United States arise from what we call Title 18 offenses, general federal criminal statutes, false statements, and in this case, failure to complete documents that by law ships coming into our nation have to keep, and that is oil record books. They have to record where their waste went. Even if they dispose of it in the high seas, if it comes into our ports with a false oil record book, it's a false statement here in our country to our federal authorities, and then it's prosecuted. So again, there's a certain attenuation. The false statement is the basis of the criminal prosecution. What we're trying to get at, of course, is the conduct on the high seas that we wouldn't otherwise have jurisdiction over. And there, I'm going to move quickly. That's what a lot of the effort has been to in the prosecution of wildlife crimes, to domesticate, to make prosecutable here conduct abroad, done through treaties, CITES treaties, our own Endangered Species Act that comes out of that treaty, the Lacey Act that prohibits cross-border commerce and illegally taken fish or wildlife, and false statements made in the importation of wildlife or in the transport of wildlife or the sale of wildlife. Let me give you a quick example. I don't have much time. This was a case that a colleague of mine did involving the import of illegal lobsters from Honduras. And this was there was a defendant here, Governor McNabb, a Honduran national, had a fleet of ships that just devastated the spiny lobster population in Honduras. It had an impact. I mean, he was taking, as you can see on the bottom, no cash limits, no size limits, taking everything he could grab, freezing it and selling it, and also had an impact on our Florida spiny lobster populations because of the migration of the lobsters and that basically they came up from the Honduran coast and supported the population of spiny lobsters in Florida. And he was charged under the Lacey Act. So this was not, the illegal harvests were not in American waters. It was in Honduras. Now, the hook, the local hook that we had was under the Lacey Act. The violation, because it was charged as of the import of a product of spiny lobster contrary to law. The law that we used to domesticate that was, the foreign law, was, down at the bottom here, it was the exportation of unprocessed seafood is a violation of Honduran law. So, no, why did Honduras pass that law? Probably because it wanted the jobs, it wanted the economic benefit of processing the seafood from their coast in their country. It was not a conservation statute, an economic one. But we were able to use that through the Lacey Act to prosecute in the United States that violation of foreign law, again, for the benefit of, for conservation and preservation of the species, not the objective for which that was passed. Mr. McNabb was found guilty on 101 counts and sentenced to jail for 8 years, as was two of his colleagues, another one for 24 years. Similar in fish, and we can go on. But the effort, again, and I will stop here, and it is a challenge, but and particularly a challenge in timber and other things, to where it's not like a drug. It's not like the thing itself is contraband. I mean, wood, you can import wood. The source is important, tracking source and finding out where it came from, and also establishing, and this is key, that it was taken in violation of a local law, and that can be our hook. Much more to be said. I will stop there and look forward to questions. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much, Jeremy. And I'm going to ask Carla to come up here. As you can all see, it's criminal to keep these experts to only 10 minutes because there's so much rich information they could share with us. So I do encourage you to follow up with them. I'm also going to say that Dirty Lobster Money is my new band name. That's the best. Dirty Lobster would be great. So let me help you with it. Is that right? Yeah. Pull it up. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Hi, guys. Good morning. Well, instead of preparing a PowerPoint, I'd rather be here sharing with you a little bit about how is to report on environmental crime in Brazil, as I believe that most of you are from the U.S., and there are huge differences between the atmosphere here and there. Just an example, yesterday in the tour, we visited a park and the Allegheny Park, and I while we were talking to the park ranger, I asked him, oh, do you have any occurrence of invaders, illegal log inside the park? And he said, no, we have huge enforcement here. We have satellites oversight, which do oversight in the area. And it's not a concern. And this is something completely different in Brazil, where we also have huge areas, but we don't have enough enforcement. There is a lack of a transparency from the government to provide information, data, and also to track who are the people who are doing the wrongdoing there. So for us as journalists, it's really challenging, but we do need to do our job because... not sure if you know, but the deforestation in the Amazon, for example, increased 29% in 2016 compared to 2015. And 80% of this deforestation is mostly comes from cattle, livestock. So, and as Megan mentioned, I recently visited the Amazon. It was the first time that I went there. And another challenge is budget. You know, I think that almost everybody, when you think about Brazil, you think about the Amazon. But we are not having enough coverage for our media there because as it's happening worldwide, they're cutting down stuff. They're not investing money to send reporters in the field. So it's really important to have some funding from the SEJ or other institutions to provide us the opportunity to do independent reporting and to show what's happening indeed in these areas. So, and the area I visited is one of the areas where deforestation has been increasing at one of the highest pace in Brazil. And I was impressed because when you think about the Amazon, you think about the forest, about this, and for example, on my way to the airport into this small city, I only saw ranchers along the entire road. They said, my God, what's going on there? And then I could see that's really a huge issue there. And even some curiosities, we stayed for 2 weeks in a small city. You think that we'll be eating fish all the time in this city? No, cattle all the time because of this. There's ranchers around. So chicken and fish just at lunchtime that you can find, you know, and chicken is more expensive to them than beef, just to have an idea. So it's a very complex country. It can be very dangerous to report about that. There is a recently Global Witness report that placed Brazil as the most dangerous country for land activists worldwide. So according to their data, I think they had 100 killings in Latin America, 49 happened in Brazil. And we believe that the numbers of these years will be even worse due to other occurrences. So another challenge that we have is to track who is behind the environmental crimes. There is a lot of corruption involved. Politicians who are there, you know, trying to approve rulings to not penalize the people who are deforesting people, changing laws, trying to know some rights that were given to indigenous communities, river dwellers, and they use a kind of front man to register property. So it's really challenging. We tried to, for example, in this area, there was a guy who was, to me, is almost the owner of the city, you know. And then, but we couldn't follow the entire chain and show what exactly he did, what he owned, and to show the wrongdoing he was doing. So it's still something that I'd like to keep pursuing. But well, I will show you a little bit of the stories we did that I think that summarize a little bit the main problems we have. Of course, that we have the wildlife crimes in the Amazon too, but in this area, we mostly focus on deforestation and gold mining. In this area, for example, it's a mining boat that we could go there, and pollution, mercury, it's a big issue there. And in this area, for example, it comes illegally from Bolivia. And then I cross the border, there is no oversight. And then you see that they bring mercury from Bolivia. And the other way, the gold they extract in the Amazon and Madeira River, they sell it in Peru without any surveillance too, because prices in Bolivia are higher than in Brazil. And when I talked to gold miners, they said, well, only 20% of our activity is illegal, but it's not. You know, there is just one a government official in charge of taking care of an entire state. It's impossible. So, you know, it's all illegal. So with it, about this, I don't have some minutes, and then I show you a video that we did there. And then the other thing, the cattle. This is a very shady slaughterhouse that we visited in the Amazon in this small city. And this guy, for example, he said, well, everybody deforests. It's impossible for us not buying meat from, you know, it's impossible for us to require that people don't deforest. But there is a law that say that 80% of the property, they need to conserve that area. But then there are rules, but they're not complying with them. And then we don't have enough enforcement, and they are getting papers. And beyond that, these people need to leave, you know. And then he said, if I don't buy meat from them, I can't sell, they can't leave. And these people barely know how to sign their names. So how would you require them to comply with a bunch of bureaucracy? So this is what's really impressed you too. Well, here is just a good example of this is indigenous community we visited. And according to data from many scholars, they say that where the land demarcation is a good thing to preserve the area, because indigenous people, river dwellers, usually they use the land to survive. They harvest, they don't destroy the trees. So, and then in this community, for example, we saw that around it's all cleared land and inside the reserve too is good. Here is another good example of high-end chocolate that's produced in a national reserve, and they export it to Germany and Switzerland. And there were a bunch of land conflicts involving small farmers and big ranchers in this area too. Yeah, and then I put it to end because there was a sign, it is a public meeting with the prosecutor there. The name of the city is Boca do Acre. And then he said, land without law, order who has money or be who does not. And that's it, because in these small areas, the public government, you know, isn't a huge presence, and then who has the money is who give the orders in these places. So, and now I will show you a video about the gold mining. This. Wow. We weren't these boats. That's it. Thank you, and I'm open to questions.
Well, thank you to all of our panelists, and now we'll go right into the Q&A. All of the stories that Carla talked about are listed on the agenda page if you want to read them, and I have a sign-up sheet going around if you would like copies of the PowerPoints or other resources. Please add your email address on there. So, thank you. And if you didn't get to sign it, it's up here. So just a reminder about the rules with Q&A. No speeches, just questions. SCJ members and journalists first. And we are going to repeat your question or attempt to repeat your question into the microphone before we answer it so that it's recorded on the audio recording of this session. So who would like to go first? Right over here, Danielle.
My name is Daniela Cheslow, and I edit at NPR Weekend Edition. My question is for Jeremy. With the new administration, where might we see a change in the focus or in the rigor with which the Department of Justice would be enforcing environmental crimes?
Question is, with the new department, with the new administration, what changes are we likely to see in the enforcement of environmental criminal statutes? I don't know. We'll see. You're asking for a prediction.
Have you seen, in the last few months, have you seen any hints of where you're changes in enforcement?
We have a fairly long pipeline, so the question. So no, I can't say that we have. I can't predict. We at the Department of Justice get case referrals from a lot of different agencies, not just EPA. EPA Criminal Investigation Division has a lot of agents we work with. They've been busy, actually, recently with storm response. A couple agents I've worked with. We've had to delay some witness interviews because they've been busy with down in Houston and Puerto Rico. That's not a programmatic issue, though. We get cases from Fish and Wildlife, of course, from NOAA. It depends upon the subject matter. Work with the FBI. So I haven't seen any, and it's hard for me to predict. Get back to me later, and I'll get back to you.
Back here.
Hi. So Bill Kovarik, Radford University. There's been a lot of concern about the murder of environmental advocates worldwide
in the past couple of years, and I'd like to know what is being done and what you think, you know, could be done, what more could be done.
So a question for everyone about what can we do about the murder of environmental activists. Who would like to go first?
Again, as I said before, there are many issues that have been raised here by my colleagues that we at the Department of Justice simply don't have any jurisdiction over.
I wasn't necessarily pointing a finger at justice, so that should be clear. I just wonder, because there's a Interpol doesn't really follow these very well. And the Global Witness Report sketches out a huge problem that is only starting to be recognized. The UN Human Rights Commission is starting to recognize the problem, but I'm just wondering if there's any ideas about, you know, what could be done, because these are all obviously associated with illegal logging, illegal mining practices, and all of that. So this is a, you know, sort of the horrible tip of the or bottom of the iceberg that, you know, we're just starting to see now. And so my question is really, Robert, what do you think might be done? Blue sky question, that how come you guys aren't doing anything?
Well, in Brazil's case, and it's extremely linked to the lack of land rights, land demarcation. And then, for example, you've seen recently land activists being murdered, small farmers by big farmers, and then they were doing kind of co-opting the police to act on behalf of these big farmers. Again, the money giving orders. And then I think in our case, we need more law enforcement, you know, and to guarantee the rights, you know, because once you demarcate the land to these people, you will avoid this kind of conflicts. Now, I'm not sure if you read recently, there was a reported murder of an uncontacted indigenous community in the Amazon, you know, and the problem is that our government, you know, is going towards the opposite way, because it's very challenging, because it's approving laws and setting back some environmental rights that were guaranteed in the last years, and now they are just going to attend to comply with private interests. So in our case, you know, so the society and us as journalists, we do need to do our job to show these problems and to claim for changes and to improve the situation. Okay.
Mary, do you want to add anything?
Can I just jump back and just make a quick comment in response to the previous question? I understand, and the Environmental Crime Section prosecutes lots of different kinds of environmental crimes within and many of them not having much to do with any particular statute. Quick example, we've been doing an awful lot of biofuel fraud. People taking advantage of tax credits that they're not entitled to, and making a lot of money by producing biofuels that don't qualify for credits, and or claiming that they produced products that they haven't. So that falls under the umbrella of environmental prosecution, but certainly that's tax fraud, and certainly we've been doing an awful lot of that to keep the regulatory system and the incentives put in place by those laws, keep them effective.
Thanks. And Mary, on the activists?
Sure. There are folks looking at this and dealing with this, certainly in our Latin America group. I do not know exactly what's happening, but I would say one of the first steps is really working on governance and ensuring that civil society has a voice, and strengthening the ability of civil society to have a voice, which is a foundation of a lot of democracy and governance programs. There are folks specifically looking at the issue of environmental activists, and I can refer you, but I can't answer your question. Thanks.
I'll just add one thing that I think is, you know, a lot of these folks are driven to activists because this is something that threatens their very livelihoods and their lives. We tend to think of environmental activism in the U.S. as kind of a luxury item that only, you know, rich people have the time for. But this is very different in other countries. So sometimes it's a matter of perspective and how we talk about it that might help bring more attention to it if we get it out of the sort of environmental bucket. Another question, Matt, right here.
John Platt, editor of The Revelator. Mary, you said USAID spends between $60 and $70 million a year on wildlife trafficking. Sounds like a lot, but it's
combating.
Also combating wildlife.
If we're on the record here, yeah.
Sounds like a lot, but it's also a drop in the bucket. How can we as journalists communicate either the value of that or really how little that is?
Well, we're not working alone. There are, and in many ways, it is one of the big funding items right now. And so you also ask, what is getting wildlife trafficking money that, you know, could be going elsewhere? The World Bank has a database of all the donors and groups who are working on it, and there's a lot of money going to wildlife trafficking. I think getting to the journalist question, I think how to get a larger voice for this, for people to be concerned, because quite often, I'm sure you're in the same boat as I am, as people sit here, environment, and they go, that doesn't matter to me. And this is a crime. This is a crime. It's stealing the natural resources from countries. It's stealing it from the communities. It's a crime. It's linked to organized criminals, organized gangs. And so making it so it matters to everyone outside of necessarily environment. But we spend about, getting to your question on the money, we spend about a quarter of our biodiversity funds on combating wildlife trafficking. We take a threats-based approach, and currently this is a big threat. But habitat fragmentation is another huge threat, and deforestation and all those. So does that sort of answer your question?
All right, all the way in the back, Mike.
Yeah, I'm Mike Casey with Associated Press. Maybe you can talk about how, like, reporters in the U.S. can localize some of these more international issues. Like, you can talk about Africa and everything, but obviously there's markets for some of this stuff. So what are some examples of ways you can localize these stories?
Okay, so the question for everyone is, how do you localize the story when you're talking about stuff that's happening outside the U.S. or even bring it home to a local or regional paper? I'd like to start. You want to start?
Well, I think that's pretty much, as I was trying to say, all we do. We as prosecutors, have to deal with specific facts and specific cases involving specific individuals and specific illegally imported items. And they're imported by manufacturing facilities that are getting timber illegally, and there are a whole set of cases involving those that we've done. Rhino horn cases, colleagues of mine have prosecuted those. Just had a prosecution of guilty pleas in an elver taking case where baby eels are taken and sold off to illegally taken along the East Coast and sold to Asian cities where they're grown and raised and then slaughtered for food. They sell at over $200 a pound. $2,000 a pound. So pretty much that's what we do. We do specific cases, and if you want to look through our docket, that would be a start.
Carla, have you seen interest, let's say, from the U.S. in your stories about Amazon?
I see that there is a very high interest in these stories. I can say because I live in Rio, and most of the international correspondents live in Rio, and I have a very good relationship with them. And after these stories were out, everybody came to talk to me. Oh, it's so good. The series of reports, we really had a really good feedback on that. And I see, I think that there is room to increase this international coverage about environmental crime, as there is something that an issue worldwide. And I think that, well, just to give you some detail, the series of reports was made by a Canadian reporter and I. We partner in this as part of a parallel program. It worked really well. And I think that if papers in the U.S. and media in the U.S. overall are interested, I think one of the best solutions is to do something, maybe a reporter here reaching professionals in the countries where we are interested, because we as locals, we get much more access to sources, we know, and even to understand how is the way to a best way to approach sources and to get information. And it happened in the field, for example, in the Amazon, you can't speak anybody, can't find anybody who is almost nobody who speaks English. For example, in this case, as a prosecutor, you know, and then the local affected communities, you know, it's impossible. So I think it is a good, if you're interested, you know, it's good to reach local reporters and do joint investigation.
So that's one way. Mary, do you have anything you want to say?
Well, I think there is a lot of local reporting in countries, and certainly there's a lot of reporting here of, I think, probably the elephants and rhinos have gotten the most press, more pangolins. But I would say also that a lot of the stories that we hear are where the demand is overseas. We are not alone. I mean, they are not alone in demanding wildlife products. The U.S., as you saw from that reptile skin map, is certainly an importer of those illegal goods, as are a lot of the pet trade, the aquarium fish trade, live coral, all those things. And that, in terms of acting locally, is something that I think needs more attention. I think one thing that it has been nice to see is an increase in the number of stories that are looking at the diversity of species that are under attack. Because when you're talking about tons of seahorses, think how big a seahorse is and that, and really understanding the scale of that. I'm going to use another scale thing with pangolins. I mean, tons of pangolin scales. And so those which really help people understand the magnitude. But I think in terms of certainly picking up stories that are overseas here and the reverse, but also be good to have some more stories about how we, as the U.S., are involved in the issue.
Just a quick add-on, if I may, and particularly in response to the plenary session, where there were complaints about apparently the government not being sufficiently forthcoming. That may be true. In certain areas, that's people have their own experiences. In what we do, publicity is very important. We don't have a deterrent effect if people don't know about what we're doing. And all of our cases are public. They're in courts. There are press releases that the Department of Justice issues on our cases. There are contacts in those press releases that you can follow up on. And you can go into the Department of Justice website, Environment and Natural Resources Division, read them. If you want to follow up on them, you can. We have a press office because we want people to know. There's no effective deterrent if this is done in silence. So have a look.
That's a good reminder. In the back?
I was just going to make a comment to follow up with your question.
Please identify yourself.
I'm Claire Jones with National Geographic Society. We actually have reporters who have gone in and looked at went past the gangs into the actual criminal syndicates that go into terrorism. So when you're talking to people and how it impacts them, that's been very salient, as well as we did a research on ivory consumption from different markets, including the United States. And the ivory particularly has a you know, high value from a feeling good about yourself, per se. And there are people who say, I love elephants, but I want the value of the ivory for my social status. So if there's a way to destigmatize the value, or actually stigmatize the ownership in a personal sense, currently, I think that's very strong. It also can make it personal to someone in town that isn't necessarily, but may go on a trip and buy something, why that's not, why they shouldn't purchase these items. Because there's a lot of United States online.
Thank you. There's a lot of different ways that reaches back into U.S. Michael?
Michael Kotis with the Center for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado. And in my own work, I've covered a variety of wildlife trade all over, particularly in Indonesia, where the legal trade of orangutans, and was kind of surprised to find it was actually some of the most threatened indigenous peoples that were involved in selling orangutans. They had lost their land to various plantations. They were under great pressure, and had a certain amount of sympathy for them. How do we cover that aspect of the illegal wildlife trade, indigenous peoples who are losing their land and other ways of making a living and are pressured into that without stigmatizing them and making their situation worse?
Okay. So the question is, how do you cover the participation of groups, particularly indigenous groups, in the wildlife trade? Is that right? Mary?
Sure. I think that's a really important point, and one of the things that makes the community conservation so key is because there you have an ally. And I would say that what a suggestion for reporting is the unintended implications of deforestation. We know that we have loss of forest, but what does it mean to the people whose livelihoods are dependent on that, who lose their lands through that, through someone coming in and offering what seems like a lot of money for a piece of land, but then it's lost forever? So I think people see deforestation as loss of trees, but it's loss of livelihoods, it's loss of species. And I think that would resonate with people. It's finding the economic alternatives and the fact that you've got people who are now landless and don't have options.
Thanks. Over here. So the question is about the pet trade into the U.S. Mary, did you want to talk a little bit?
I can talk a bit about that, since I mentioned it. And I would refer you to the Department of Interior Fish and Wildlife site for some of that information. Also, the uswildlifetrade.org, and I'm sure I'm getting that wrong, but Wildlife Trafficking Alliance, thank you, .org, because they're certainly looking at that. U.S. Wildlife Trafficking Alliance.org. I should know that, but I don't. Trafficking Alliance. Okay. And that will give you a lot more facts. But in terms of the pet trade, one of the things you're dealing with is a relatively small portion of the animals are arriving alive. An awful lot get lost in the capture and delivery. But certainly in the press, you see just mind-boggling stories of someone who's carrying 10 snakes on their body on a plane. I mean, that's really uncomfortable to imagine. Or carrying toilet paper tubes with finches in them. And they have 20 finches. I know that customs have found suitcases with tiger cubs in them. There's a lot going on, and I would recommend those two sites for more information.
Do you have any case examples on the pet trade?
Actually, in my presentation, I have all kinds of interesting photographs of where animals were found on and where eggs were found. I can show them to you, but pretty exotic stuff. And as you just said, Mary, photographs of lots of dead birds that were taken in. I mean, they get a few alive and sell them, but the mortality on some of these illegal imports is really stunning.
And I met with a woman who wrote a book called The Extinction Market, and there's a flyer back there, and she told me a story that said, the loss of lives, actually, the smugglers don't care because it just makes the product more valuable. So they don't really care how many they lose, because the rarer they are, the more value they have. So, more questions? In the back?
My name is Prima Joshi. I work with Michigan State University's Mann Center for Environmental Journalism. endangered conservation crime. My question is for Mary and Jeremy. So both of you talked about how behavior change is hard and attitude change needs to kind of precede behavior change. What kind of work, if any, are you aware of that's being done in, to that end to bring about attitude change? And Mary, you talked about how disrupting and dismantling trafficking is one of the goals of your organization. What kind of interventions are being implemented to that end?
Let's start with the last one first.
The last one first, in terms of dismantling. We are not operational. We have Fish and Wildlife, NOAA are certainly operational, and Fish and Wildlife has attachés overseas looking at this. A lot of what USAID does is build capacity, and so it's build capacity of the judiciary, build capacity of the prosecutors, of the forensic science, working with legislators to make sure that, that laws are on the books that where the penalties fit the crime. And so a lot of what we do is bringing capacity. One of the things that I wasn't able to talk about is the U.S. task force and the group of agencies working on this. So it is State Department, both policy and the International Narcotics and Law section, and they have sizable funds towards this. Fish and Wildlife, Department of Justice, NOAA. There's 17 agencies that are working. And then last year, Congress passed the Eliminate, Neutralize, and Disrupt Wildlife Trafficking Act that was signed last October. And then President Trump, in his executive order, I don't remember the name of it, but it's February 7th, on transnational organized crime, did mention wildlife trafficking as an organized crime. And so there's those items. But in terms of what we do at USAID, it's a lot of working with along the enforcement chain. We also are working with the private sector. As you can imagine, those big maps of things moving around, how are they doing that? It's the it's using legal transport to transport illegal items. So working with the airline industry and shipping companies to try and help them see what they can do to help customs officers and others to identify when their routes are used for illegal use.
Mary, is that task force still functioning under Trump?
It's in the END Act. It is part of what's covered in the Eliminate, Neutralize, and Disrupt Wildlife Trafficking Act. And so it's in there, and then there are other processes that were passed in October that add more to that group.
The question, how do you change attitudes? You have to help. You have to make people understand the consequences of their conduct. And as I said in the beginning of my talk, that has been a challenge in environmental regulation to begin with, because what we've done is to make illegal and then to criminalize by statute conduct that had been for forever perfectly legal. And it's important for people to understand the impact of their actions on environments, on other people, on the resources on which we all rely. And that is the task of journalists as well as folks like me.
Justin, on demand behavior reduction, demand reduction behavior change, it is a specialized field. And I think most of us can think of the health sector, who's done a lot of it, anti-smoking campaigns, making it personal, making it important to you, not just saying smoking is bad for you, but explaining it. And it depends. It really needs to be focused on the product. If you're talking about rhino horn that's used for status, how do you confer a different status to it? If it's a luxury item or a pet, how do you change... knowing that something's rare and endangered may not work, but how do you get people to focus on something that's sustainable? How do you give them, how do you change their buying behavior? I think one of the most successful campaigns that we were involved with was on shark fin, which is often used as a banquet item in many countries in Southeast Asia, and getting both companies and hotels and governments to stop serving shark fin as a banquet item. And so, therefore, if the government's not doing it, the status goes down. And so there are a number of variety of ways.
Yeah, these are really huge issues. If you can think about how hard it is to change behavior, just your own behavior, I can imagine. One thing I just want to say is I encourage everybody to look at the END Act. If you're interested in that, you haven't read it, please check it out. I mean, this is a congressional act that passed, I believe, unanimously bipartisan support for this act, and it requires the administration to do a number of things. And so it's a good thing to look into because the administration is required by law to produce certain reports and to move forward on certain things. Sharon?
Well, that's a perfect segue for my question. I'm Sharon Vine, I'm a writer. I'm really curious to know exactly, you know, how the government is moving forward, you know, with the END Act, you know, what the task force is doing. I attended a meeting that was about a year and a half ago where all of the government agencies were trying to figure out how they could get involved, and government agencies that normally would not be involved in you know, controlling wildlife trafficking. So, you know, agencies like the FBI and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just really curious to see, you know, what is being done, and is the whole of government truly being, you know, drawn in? Is this literally sitting on books, or is something happening?
So a question about the implementation of the END Act.
It's going. It's been a very busy summer. The first set of reports due to Congress under the END Act are actually early this month, and so stay tuned for both a progress report of what's happening under the END Act from the agencies, and also listing one of the things that's required under the END Act is a list of focus countries. Where wildlife trafficking both source, demand, and transit. And then there's also another list of countries of concern where governments are complicit in corruption. And those are two big items under the END Act, and you can see those deadlines in the Act. And so, yes, it's a very, I would say, engaged interagency. The three co-chairs continue. USAID sits with them, and we have a lot of meetings. And there is both with the last spending bill, the 16 spending bill, both USAID and State Department, INL, have earmark funds, and then there's also Fish and Wildlife during their appropriations and others. There's a great deal of effort. And one of the things that I think is really important is both what host countries do and what the international community does. There's a whole process, a London process, which started 3 years ago, and there will be another meeting next fall probably on that where it's governments getting together to say what's necessary. So we're not in this alone, but I can say, yes, we are working on the END Act.
Becky?
Hi, my name is Matilda Kreider. I'm a student at George Washington University and an intern with the Wilderness Society. My question is about how people working internationally on these issues can avoid like steamrolling the work being done by people from those countries, I guess, like how they can work with domestic, say, sub-African countries, like agencies working on preventing wildlife trafficking, rather than taking it over.
So the question is, how do you, international or U.S.-based organizations work with local groups on the ground? Carla, do you want to see, do you have any examples from the Amazon or Brazil?
I can't remember a specific example, but I know that some government departments and NGOs in Brazil, they work in partnership with U.S.-based and other institutions based in other countries. So, especially because some issues are international. Some illegal gold, illegal wildlife that come from Brazil goes to other countries, so they kind of do a cooperation with that. I can look for more information and send along to you if you're interested. Okay.
I'd just like to ask a question, since I've been asked questions. It seems to me that there's a big elephant sitting in the middle of the room. We've been talking about, without ivory tusks, but we've been talking about essentially an effort to control the theft of resources and the appropriation of resources. We've been talking about competition for food sources, for clean water, for timber, for wildlife. And we've been talking about treaties and enforcement efforts and community action to try to prevent the harm. Does human population have anything to do with this? This is my opinion. If there were 100 million people in the world, we probably wouldn't need any environmental regulation at all. And, again, my opinion that environmental law, what I do in terms of pollution control, other stuff in terms of wildlife and resource conservation, that is all. Those legal efforts are all a footnote, a small one, to human population. And I wonder whether, and since I'm talking to journalists here, is that a story to be told? It just simply seems to be absent.
One comment on that before I ask Mary to respond. For the last couple of years, actually, I've organized panels at this conference on the relationship between population and the environment. It's usually the only panel on that conversation. There isn't one this year. Actually, there's, as far as I can tell, on the agenda, no panels on that theme. It's a tricky one for people to report on for a lot of different reasons. But Mary, I want to give you a chance to
not on that one, but on the international development. We are very decentralized. We have our technical offices in country. We have folks in Washington, but 85% of our funds, certainly in biodiversity, go out to our country missions, and they work with host government, and they are full. They are partners on our programs, and there's certainly a focus on funding both local and international NGOs. Is it perfect? Probably not. But it is certainly in concert with the stakeholders, both civil society and government, that the bulk of the work gets done. And certainly in terms of capacity building on this particular issue, a lot is done with government officials.
More questions. Let's see. It's anybody who hasn't asked a question yet. Anybody else? Okay, Mike, and then Mike.
I guess two-part question is, can you suggest any good resources? Like you mentioned the Justice Department's case. Well, but are there other good resources where someone's kind of looking to see trends and stuff like that they might want to look at? Secondly, Mary, you mentioned ivory and rhinos. If you had to pick three species that would produce a story in terms of either the trafficking is really having an impact or... You mentioned pangolin, which has got a lot of attention. What are a couple of species that are really in trouble because of it, but haven't gotten the attention that you think are worth writing about?
Okay, so one question about resources for tracking trends in this area. And then the other on what hasn't gotten the attention it needs. Let's just start down here real quick. What are the resources that you used, Carla, when you were working on your story? Anyone that would be good for the reporters to look at?
Well, I think that the main, for example, the guy that helped us a lot in the field, he worked for an NGO in Brazil, and this NGO receives funding for Germany. And I see that there is a lot of interest in other countries that are funding how to help to protect the environment in Brazil. And we have very active NGOs in Brazil who have material in English too. I can, if you're interested, they can send along some links and contacts too.
Okay. And Jeremy, you already mentioned the press release page. Are there other parts of?
Yeah. That's where I'd start. That's what I'm most knowledgeable about.
Okay. And Mary.
Sure. I would direct folks, I mean, there are many sites out there, but certainly traffic.org, the World Trafficking Monitoring Network, Wildlife Trafficking Network, is a great source, and there are a lot of reports on that. And I think you'll actually get a lot of ideas of species to track on that. I think in terms of things that don't get enough attention, a lot of it is the pet trade, be it primates or birds or reptiles. And then the vast number of animals that are poached for meat and are sold internationally. But there's a myriad of species, and unfortunately there's always some new focus. So traffic.org.
All right, I'm sorry, Michael, we're going to hold your question because I got the signal that we have to go. So let's, before we do, let's thank the panelists for this discussion. And thank you all for coming.